Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, the immaculate.
Now listen to this.
I have arrived. Dr. Mark here on Soma Time. Wow. The day goes quickly when the day goes bad. I don't know how that works, but what do I know? Law of attraction? Whatever. So there we are again, my sapient ears. We have an interesting show tonight. I don't know if you want to call it something that's provocative, but for this show, maybe. You know, and I actually had the opportunity to try and describe this show earlier, and I got a little fancy. You always try to describe it in what you aspire it to be. So I said it's a kind of a cross between a Michael Toms NPR, you know, New Dimensions kind of show, because we get into the sciencey weird stuff. And it also has a little Dave Barry in it, you know, a little common man kind of sitting on his porch going, what? So the kind of mix of those two is what you get here on Soma Time every week on Wednesday nights at 9 o'clock. And tonight will be no exception. But first, in honor of our guests and in honor of the absolute, just horrible decision to come down to Washington today about the Gitmo situation, we need to speak to one of our founding fathers. He has both guidance and suggestions for us here. So let's just take a listen to our friend John Adams here.
By God, I have had this Congress. For 10 years, King George and his Parliament have gulled, cullied, and diddled these colonies. And still this Congress refuses to grant any of my proposals on independence, even so much as the courtesy of open debate. Good God, what in the hell are they waiting for?
All right, man. Thank you, John. And the theme of opening up a window is we're going to get to on the shoe in a minute here with our guests, the Brain Spotters. But first, as we transition from dead presidents to dead people, the swine friend is wreaking havoc in the New York metropolitan area, in case you're not aware. And King Bloomberg is... he's really getting smacked around. We got a dozen schools in New York City that are being closed because of the swine flu outbreak. And we have a situation on Rikers Island where there are four people, I don't know if they're prisoners, maybe guards, I don't know, that have contacted it, and they're freaking out about that. We had the death of Mitchell Weiner last weekend, 55-year-old assistant principal in Queens. And... he passed away. We have another little child that might be the second casualty. And it's getting funky. It's getting funky. And I think the total in New York State, okay, around the world we have almost 9,000 in 40 countries, 74 deaths, 68 of them in Mexico, 5,000 in the States out of that, 8,800 or so. And it's getting funky out there for the swine friend. My advice has been since this started, okay, has been that it is, well, first we have to hear from Margaret Chan, the WHO director, who said the virus's lethality can vary from country to country. This is the smartest virus on the planet. No, it's not to go to Canada. You know, H1N1 virus has not been especially lethal, but this could be the calm before the storm. So if you think you're safe, you're not safe. The swine friend leaves its mark. And, you know, we've had several guests on. We're going to have these guys on in a minute here to discuss that with us as I silence the lamb here. But yeah, there you go. WHO, CDC, Bloomberg, closing the schools, all is well. Keep shopping. Enjoy your weekend. Gas is up 25 cents. There's the swine friend report. We have a couple more casualties, as we do every year from the flu. But you know what? You know, I've already made my case here every week. You can go back and listen to the archives. It's wearing me out. And my immune system, believe me, gets its chances to be worn out by you sapes. So one way or the other. Again, the number tonight, 646-478-4847. If you'd like to partake with us, interrupt my my banter with the guests and all that, who should be along in a couple of minutes. You know, we have a lot of things on the plate today. It's one of those interesting nights. Like I mentioned, the Gitmo thing, along the lines of the whole terror thing, which won't go away. Anything that's different is dangerous. That's pretty much the theme in this country for a long time. So that's where we're at with that. All right, I see our first guest has chimed in. We're waiting for the other guy. But we're a couple minutes early. Got a couple of things to cover. Vis-a-vis, if I can find it here, let's see if I'm like, I don't know how flexible I am tonight on the, let's see, I wanted to do this in two screens, but of course the, oh, there you go. This is my life. Yeah, the Mets have been driving me nuts on the West Coast trip, so I figured that since, in honor of Daniel Murphy's first appearance on at first base tonight, we would take a listen to a little of this before we get into the game tonight.
Look, Mr. Flores, I mean, after all, if you're in a ballpark, how you love it?
See, I should have queued this up, but the free show, so. They're actually throwing shoes at Abbott.
Now, look, then you'll go and pay your who's on for it? That's what I want to test out on the St. Louis team.
Here we go.
Who's on first? What's on second? I don't know's on third.
That's what I want to find out. I want you to tell me the names of the fellas on the St. Louis team.
I'm telling you, who's on first? What's on second? I don't know's on third.
Do you know the fellas' names?
Yes.
Well, then who's playing first?
Yes.
I mean the fellow's name on first base.
Who?
The fellow playing first base for St. Louis.
Who?
The guy on first base.
Who is on first?
Well, what are you asking me for?
I'm not asking you. I'm telling you. Who is on first?
I'm asking you who's on first.
That's the man's name.
That's whose name?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
Who?
Daniel Murphy. Daniel Murphy, he of the butcher performance in the outfield, gets a shot at first base tonight in the rotisserie league that is the New York Mets. So we'll be monitoring that in the 10 o'clock hour offline. So here we are. That's... I can't even get started with this team. The manager's an exo. Okay, now if you ever work for someone, a boss that is an exo, you can tell you can pick up all the signals. Okay, there is no interiority. There is only the task at hand. They don't go backwards. They don't go forwards. They're just like a freaking Sherman tank. And there are bodies strewn all around on this team. They're getting hurt. They're playing out of position. They're calling guys up in the minor leagues that are 36 years old with jaundiced eyes. You know, they're such a team that is just riddled with leadership issues. They've got the one Philo that got hurt at first base. He's out for 11 weeks. They got the Philo at third base who doesn't want to lead you to a water fountain, let alone lead the team. He now is the reluctant messiah. They've got old pitchers, old guys on the bench. They got Methuselah there with the steroids there. What's his name? What the heck's his name? You know, come on, help me out here. Damn. I keep seeing Sherwood, but that was a guy I played ball with when I was a kid. Oh, boy. A blank. Anyway, you know his name. The whole bond thing. It'll come back to me like when it doesn't matter in a couple minutes. But anyway, I did a little essay on that on blogsoma.net. You can go check that out about a week and a half ago before they started going into the tank. And it's been interesting. As they say, being a Met fan this year, it's... It's just one of those things. But the Yankees across the street, of course, are triumphantly going toward their, I think, their eighth victory tonight in a row. They lead 5-3 in the seventh inning, going to the eighth inning now with the illustrious bullpen to come in to nail it down. You know. So anyway, I can't think of his name yet. Sherwood, Shringwood, I don't know. We have one of our guests here. The other one's going to be along soon. And, little stat. We normally have 10,000 deaths a year due to regular flus. Thank you for the contribution. And most of them are older people. So, who knows? Like I said, I think a lot of this is a lot of fear spreading more than disease, but that's me. Anyway, now I got to know this guy's name. I can see him. Oh, God, I had it. They dropped it again. Maybe I have a brain spot. Maybe that's my problem tonight. I don't know. I do? No. I'm going to go find out. All right, let's do two things at once, like we always do in the show. I'll pop up our first guest, and we'll wait for the second one to join us. How about that there? All right, I believe... Oh, there's the two of them. Wow, look at that. All right, let's get this lined up. First, we need a little...
All right, that's it. He's fired.
Yeah.
Can I talk to you, Val?
Yeah, okay. Please.
I'm back.
All right. And let's see. The Soma submarine, I believe, is somewhere on this thing. There it is. Okay. So joining us now from two locations that we are not aware of is our guests, David Graham and Cynthia Schwartzenberg. Right? Did I say that right? Schwartzenberg. Okay.
Schwartzenberg.
Sorry. Schwartzenberg. All right. Thanks for joining us here on Soma Time. Welcome to the program.
Welcome, and the name you're searching for is Gary Sheffield.
That's it. You see, I had Sherwood. I had a brain spot. I actually had a moment there where I could not see the name. Gary Sheffield. I know him, I love him. You can't live without him. The 40-year-old guy stealing third base last week, and then he got sick or something. I don't know what happened to him over the weekend, but I digress with my Mets. And you actually have experience, David, with the Mets, with the whole Mackey Sasser thing, which
yep.
is kind of a perfect example to segue into what brain spotting is and how it can help people overcome these, I don't know if they're senior moments with me, but whatever, where you sort of go out of sync between the way the brain and the body are communicating. So why don't you give that little synopsis as a way to introduce the process, and then we'll get into some of the nuts and bolts.
Okay, well, I want to start by saying hello to Cynthia, who's a dear friend of mine.
Hi.
Yeah. Okay.
How you doing,
you
Cynthia?
Go.
Hi.
Okay. This is the story on brain spotting. Eye position. Where we look coordinates to where information is held in the brain, whether it's neutral information, positive information, or negative information. Anything that makes us feel bad when we're feeling bad is more active in some areas of the brain than other areas. Okay? And where we look either puts us closer in touch with it or further away from it. So a brain spot is an eye position that we look at that coordinates with anything that we feel in the brain, but it, from a clinical point of view, it coordinates to where we're holding trauma or anxiety or other things in the brain. Okay?
Okay.
The brain is a problem-solving mechanism, okay? And basically it solves almost every problem that comes to it, but some things kind of vex it, like trauma gets stuck or other things. So when we find the eye position that coordinates with it and have the person look right at that spot, it holds the brain focused right on that area, and it goes to work on it and starts to unravel it and unwind it and kind of resolve it.
And I'm familiar with some of the eye positions from, my NLP training, and maybe some of the audience is familiar with it, where, visual recall be looking up to the left and things like that. Is it on that kind of a map, or is it more just any position where the eyes are where you feel there's a physiological glitch?
Yeah. The thing about brain spotting is there is no map for each person, and what the brain spotting therapist looks to do is to find that particular person's map, okay? And again, so if you're looking up to the right for something, well, it might be that way for somebody, but for the other person, it might be down to the left. So what we do is we do scanning or mapping with a person who's really activated around an issue and they're aware of where they're holding it in their body. And from there, we go across, and a person will tell us where they feel it the most, or we'll observe where the most reflexive activity is in the person's field of vision. That also tells us that there's something there.
Okay. And I know, your background is in a lot of the EMDR work, which has the moving the eyes back and forth, side to side. So this is more about finding a fixed position to hold the eyes in as they're discussing the issue, or you're basically having what would amount to being a therapeutic conversation about an issue they're facing, and the therapist is then noting where the eyes are going as they discuss it. Is that the way you kind of discover where to go?
Well, actually, you're getting to one of my further advanced discoveries, which is that if you watch where a person is looking while they're talking about what's bothering you, they'll kind of tip to you where it is in their field of vision, or at least where some connecting point is. And if you have them just keep on looking at that spot and be aware of what's bothering them, again, that's another way of finding a brain spot. But what we do is literally we have a person track our fingers or a pointer that we use, because it's kind of hard to hold your fingers up. We have them slowly track a pointer, and we ask them, where do you feel it the most? You know, let me know where you feel it the most. Going horizontally across the visual field, and when we find that spot, whether it's to the left, the middle, or right, we then go up and down vertically to see whether the person feels it more above eye level, at eye level, or below. And from that, it's very fine-tuned. People will say, no, you passed it. Go back a little bit. It's right there. And that's the way we map it. And once we find it, we just hold it in place until it processes through.
Okay. And the processing part is more of a biofeedback situation where they're breathing or they close their eyes or change position, or is it something that you guys can nuance client to client?
Yeah. But the processing is the same thing as mindfulness, only this is a kind of focused mindfulness where a person is observing their internal process while they're on that spot.
Mm-hmm.
And the brain, you know, it just goes from one thing to the next to the next. Sometimes memories come up, sometimes it jumps around, sometimes it's all more body sensations. But whatever is going on inside is actually the person's brain working the problem out.
Okay. So, like, again, going back to the NLP world, they would have somebody do an internal process to see or hear or do something to be more resourceful to let that image or that memory become more conscious. You're just focused on holding a physical eye position and allowing the person to just linger there long enough to let the state shift on its own. Is that the way that things unwind in your world? Or?
I mean, that's an accurate way of saying it. We call it processing. And processing means just the internal process, what comes next, which is actually the brain and the body just kind of unwinding it. But the whole thing is it's not guided, okay? It's guided from the internal experience, because if you try to guide something, you're trying to make the brain do something from the outside that it does much better left to its own devices and sort of held in the right place, which is the brain spot itself.
All right, Teach. Now let's go over to Cynthia here, because this is the learning curve for me too and the listeners here. You're hearing this genius talk about all this stuff, and it's remarkable information, because he's mapping things that are, you know, basically terra incognita to most of us walking around trying to chew gum and walk anyway. As you're learning this process, with all your training and all your wonderful interventions, energetic and otherwise, how did this one sort of become the one that drives the bus for you in terms of getting people from A to B?
I think that the main thing for me is the lack of kind of invading or imposing on the client.
Okay.
So with this, it's the no assumption model and really being mindful to the client and holding the space for the client that has really helped make the big shift.
And the client that's coming to you for this type of work, are they pre-framed? Are they given an advance warning and this is not, you know, your father's intervention kind of a thing? Or is it something that they walk through the process, you know, one step at a time as they go in? Because there's so many modalities out there. There's so many things that are in the realm of mindfulness in terms of processing things, somatic recall, whatever you want to call it, that this is brain spotting as a name sounds like fun. But the process is bringing up a lot of icky stuff that some people might not be willing to experience right away, and maybe something comes up that they didn't plan on. Did you ever have to do one of those, put the genie back in the bottle as you're learning this? Because it seems like it's something like you're saying, it's an emergent process where you don't know what's going to come up once they hold that spot, that things just kind of unwind on their own. So how did you prepare yourself and the client for what could be an unknown result?
I just, by letting them know how much I trust it.
Okay.
Like, I'm not, whatever comes up, it's fine. And if I'm really sitting with that and knowing that, then they know that I'm trusting it, and that mirrors back to them that they can trust anything that comes from within them, and mm-hmm. they can learn to trust themselves.
All right, well, just back to David here. How much neurological awareness does the practitioner need to have of that individual to know that, you know, they might be in a post-traumatic stress situation, or they might be in a situation where they're not able to access information due to some other mitigating factor that you might have to incorporate into this zoning out, especially when you're dealing with the countless kids out there that have problems, just, you know, what you say with the tracking of the finger. Some of them aren't able to go across the midline because their eyes aren't hooked up together. How do you overcome those obstacles?
Well, actually, we don't find that to be a particular problem. But remember, someone who does brain spotting is also a psychotherapist, a clinician.
Right.
So a clinician kind of knows, first of all, how to engage a person, how to listen to a person, how to really mm-hmm. ask the right kind of questions. And that's all part of the preparatory work for doing brain spotting, which is to really find out, first of all, why the person is coming, you know, what's the problem, what help they want with it, and to sort of figure out from there what adds up to the problem, and from there the best application to it. Now, brain spotting is not a standalone process, because we don't just get a person on a spot and let them sit there unless it just kind of works out on its own, which sometimes happens. You really have to track the person. You have to really go with the person, and sometimes add in different techniques, more of an ego state, you know, or like working with different parts of the person, or
mm-hmm.
more of a gestalt technique or some hypnosis. So there's a lot of mix and match that goes on with it also. But to address the question that you asked Cynthia before, I have no problems with people coming to me doing this newfangled treatment. I mean, I'm fortunate a lot of people refer to me because I do it, but When a person comes to me to get the best help they can, and I know that this is the best way I can help them, you don't have problems with people, you know, when you really believe in it and you come across with courage and enthusiasm, and you can also give a cogent explanation for, like, what the hell's going on. So that doesn't seem to be a problem for me. And, Cynthia, I don't know if you want to kick in.
Yeah, I wanted to say something else about that, because people come to me for all kinds of issues, like restless leg, car accidents, chronic, you know, problems, depression, anxiety. When they come to me, they're coming to me for their outer issue. And then in the process of working with them, I offer them this as a tool and a way to help them.
Okay.
So it's like they're not – some and people do also come for the EMDR. And
mm-hmm.
whatever they come for, if I know that this might be something that I think could be beneficial – because it is so beneficial to people, I will suggest it and, you know, explain it to them in the session so they can have the opportunity to try it.
Now, I'm curious, how do you make a distinction for the public between an EMDR protocol and this? Like, when would they transition from an EMDR process to doing brain spotting, or do you not even bother telling them you're doing either one?
I just say that I teach when they come to me, if they come for EMDR, then I will also share with them the development of going from EMDR to brain spotting, because David originally found the brain spotting from having worked with, I mean, David, you can say more about it.
How has the EMDR community embraced your innovation? Because it would sound like you found a better mousetrap here.
Well, you know, every community is varied, okay?
Yes.
Now, if someone came along and came up with something that did what brain spotting does much better, okay, and I'm the discoverer and I'm the brain spotting guy,
right?
I wouldn't say, oh, boy, I got to keep that under wraps. This guy's threatening my territory. I'd say, you know what? Teach me what you got, okay? Let me go for it, okay? So for the most part, you know, therapists, EMDR therapists, other therapists, we know that the brain is so complex that there's no, like, one way or one right way to do it. We're always looking for more ways to do it. And most people in the EMDR community are like that, and they're, you know, many, many people who come for trainings have background in EMDR and end up either using both together or one more than the other, but it doesn't really matter. But, you know, there may be a few people who are saying, well, you know, what about this, what about that? But they're not really, like, looking for that what's going to help their clients the most. They're kind of
mm-hmm.
trapped in the paradigm of TURF, which, you know what, when it comes to healing, there ain't no TURF.
Well, I'm glad to say that, because this is something that maybe Cynthia and I, as table rats, might know. There's such a polarity, I guess, in the field between the sort of the practitioner side of the coin, which is highly competitive for some silly reason, especially when we're dealing with the woo side. Like, there's not enough drugs out there. So when someone actually says, "I'm going to try and do something natural," the backstabbing and the like, say, the turf wars that go on between the little modalities that no one can shine a flashlight between, mm-hmm. as far as the public's concerned. It's really maybe there needs to be some type of a meta process where we can get the brain spots out of the practitioner pool that keeps us in this carnivorous sort of, like, you know, those are my eyes, those are my eyes. Because I just, in chiropractic, I ventured onto the psychological turf of dealing with behavior, and you would have thought, you know, that I had committed some type of treason within both communities, actually.
Can I say something about that, Mark?
Yeah.
As being this student, is that I think what the blessing of brain spotting is that mm-hmm. it's so encompassing, and I come with a different background than somebody else who does brain spotting.
Mm-hmm.
But then you just include whatever you already have, and it integrates. It's not exclusive, it's inclusive.
Well, yeah, as an eclectic practitioner and with an eclectic client, you got a checker and a checker there. I mean, you could throw holy water at them and they'd be happy. I mean, they're just having an experience, and they're interested in transformation, and they're open. Lion's share of the public, you know, like, I just came out of the CVS over here, and people are symptom chasers and they're state chasers, and they'll truck up to, I think David was just up at Omega, like it's Lord's, you know, like,
right.
I'm getting the healing on here. And there's still, in a sense, like you talked about, and we'll get into this window thing because I think it's fascinating, that people live, and we talked about it last week on the show with somatic kahuna there, is that people will create a third-person perspective of their own body, especially when it comes to things that are internal like this, instead of being able to experience it in a first-person way and sort of put words to the music. So because we're focusing on eyes, if we're dealing with eye conditions, you know, someone has strabismus, someone has convergence issues, someone has problems with like astigmatism where the light's bouncing all around in there, just the fact that we're moving eyes around. I mean, I've had to deal with clients that'll get, you know, vertigo reactions from doing what I call simples, which is basically making figure eights and crosses with your eyes in tune with your breathing. How do you get past, because people get, and we talk about the yips, we're going to get into that a little bit too. How do you get past those cultural obstacles that kind of couches everything in the framework of treatment, disorder, dysfunction, disease, you know, and get them into the other mindset that's more salutogenic, that's more looking at functional aspects and wholeness and well-being? Again, is that a pre-frame or is that a person-to-person transfer? That was a big one. Okay, I'll back off.
Okay.
You guys jump in.
Hold on a second. Are you talking about the clients or are you talking about other therapists or the field?
Well, basically, because this is an interactive process, if you get allopathically oriented practitioners and allopathically oriented clients, no big deal. It's when you get the mismatch. It's when you get the holistic practitioner who's looking at function, looking at well-being, like Cynthia's talking about, and you get the symptom-based, ouchy-ouch kind of client that isn't really going to want to go deeper than relief for these conditions, and vice versa when you get the allopathic, and it doesn't happen much, the allopathically oriented client and the holistic practitioner. So it's more the cultural kind of mismatch you get when you're learning a new modality like this, because the meaning of what happens could be interpreted either way.
Well, brain spotting is sort of like where West meets East, because although it is sort of an energy therapy and it's an unconventional therapy, it also is based on neurophysiology, okay? And when clients come in and when I do trainings, I give very clear neurophysiological explanations for what's going on and why we do what we do and what we know and what we think is happening. So I keep it pretty much grounded in Western science, even at the same time as it goes along with a lot of the Eastern ideas of you know, meditation and mindfulness and self-healing. So we don't really have too much of a problem with that, not only with clients but with people who come for the trainings. The only problem, and this is not like for brain spotting per se, but for other, like EMDR and other therapies, is academia and researchers who are like, who, if you don't have hypothesis testing research that says, you know, that proves your one variable, then they say, well, you have no proof that it works. You know, you could,
wow,
you could cure
welcome
a thousand
to my
people.
World.
Yeah. you could line up 1,000 people who were totally emotionally crippled before, and now they're dancing and so on. They say, you have no proof that what you did got that result.
That's the oldest thing in chiropractic, that if Jesus came back, they would say, you know, Lazarus comes out of the cave. Anecdotal, you know.
I think there's one other thing, too, Mark, with them. When you were asking David about how it's done and how you find the brain spot, with those people that are more symptom-oriented and are not really going to be looking at a pointer and thinking that that pointer is going to do anything for them, I can just do it through tracking them and saying, why don't you hold your eyes there while you keep talking about that? So there's a way...
That's the subtle nuance of being a professional and being able to kind of like basically get them there any way you can, and that's the eclectic bag of tricks that makes you sort of the gypsy cab driver of their mind for that session, because I always try to get this across to the practitioners I work with, is that there are two of you in the room. So it's like if you're the more resourceful one in that moment, you don't have to sit there and watch them like a turtle on their back struggle to do it. You do another way to get them there.
Right.
You know, and I always look at, they're not changing. I'm like, well, do something. Help them. It's like if you were a lifeguard, you'd get them out of the water. It's like I always find it funny how when people learn procedures and sort of a cookbook way of doing things, whether it's acupuncture, whether it's no matter what the procedure is really, they get bound by that, and if like step 7 doesn't work, they just stop and they go, okay, that's where it ends today, and they have again that comes with time, it comes with dealing with hundreds of people, and you know that's the clinicians or the practitioners' learning curve as well, to know when to kind of push, when to pull, when to watch, when to wait, you know, all of that is the healing art that you can't put in the brochure, because again the little fine print, your mileage may differ, and it's like. And that's why, you know, they always say in my world, upstream anyway, they would say, you know, who's a chiropractic assistant that works for you for 5 years? And they'd say, well, it's a spouse, because no one else can stand you that long. And when it comes to therapy, it's one of those things where we talk about a lot with physical therapy, always seems to have a finite number of sessions and a finite amount of time. This is your therapy. It's 6 weeks. It's 3, 4, 5 times a week. Whether you're good, bad, or indifferent, you're out. It's over. It's like people are limping out of their physical therapist after a month and a half, and they're done. It's like, wait a minute. So it's more about just enduring the sessions than it is about getting a mutually agreed upon result. Whereas with your work, you're going to get massive shifts vertically within any session, and this kind of transitions to giving an example of what happened with Mackie Sasser, where a person's coming in, maybe they've been to 6, 7, 8, 10 different specialists all over the dial, and now they're wandering in for this, and I can imagine when they get in the car to tell their family and friends, I'm going to a brain spotting session. Hello? And you know, they've already been up the mountain 6, 7, 8 times, and especially with Mackie, it was a lifelong issue with him after the accident. I think it was 17 years he suffered from that problem. Is that people don't know Mackie Sasser, he's an old catcher for the Mets that had a collision, and after the collision he had an inability to throw the ball back to the pitcher, which as a catcher, that could get in the way. And it unraveled his career. And David was able to work with him way after that to resolve it, and he now enjoys a different quality of life. So why don't you give us a little minute or two on Mackie and how you came in contact with him, and maybe you can help Pelfrey not fall off the mound in a couple of days.
Well, I was going to mention that, but
you're a Met fan, then. Are you a Met fan, card carrying, or you can't take sides?
I went to a Met game in the Polo Grounds in 1963. Okay,
all right, then there you go.
All right, is that my cred?
That's it. You're
okay.
In.
Okay.
So Mackie.
I go back to Choo Choo Coleman. So all
wow.
Right. Don't mess with me.
This is scar tissue there.
Now Mackie Sasser. Now by the way, this is the thing. Trauma and dissociation is key to brain spotting. It's key to mental health. It's key to everything. okay? And it's key to performance and it's key to sports. But when it comes to sports psychology, these guys don't know jack about trauma, and they know even less about dissociation. Sports injuries are physical and psychological trauma simultaneously, okay? And every athlete gets them, and they get them over and over again, and sometimes they get them real bad, okay? Mm. But they keep on doing all this other stuff, you know, cognitive work and relaxation and visualization, when meanwhile the guy's carrying all this stuff in his brain, and every time it knocks off of it, you know, he goes into a slump or he can't throw the ball or yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
Mackie Sasser saw 50 people in, you know, 50 different therapists, hypnotists, you know, all kinds of people. And when I worked with him, he told me not one of them ever asked about his trauma history or his sports injury history, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So they weren't looking for something because they didn't even know it was there, okay? And that's why a guy, all of a sudden, he can throw the ball down to second base, but he can't throw it back to the pitcher, you know? It's like that is... In the field of trauma and dissociation, we know that's a dissociative symptom. A loss of function is a dissociative symptom. That's like in the ABCs of it. But when it comes to sports psychology, it doesn't exist. So with Mackie, I took a history with him. You know, and now his problem was he's a college coach in Alabama, and he has trouble throwing batting practice. And if for some reason he's throwing it that day, somebody comes along just to watch, you know, nothing special, then all of a sudden he locks up. He can't throw the ball anymore. He still has the same problem, you know, all these years later, because he had it back, you know, from the late 80s to the mid-90s. So I take his history, and this guy's got traumas in and out of sports up and down the line. And what I did with him, I processed, using brain spotting, each trauma one at a time, and we just kind of knocked them off. It was like, you know, duck hunting season until there were no more ducks in the sky. Mm-hmm. And he was able to actually imagine himself throwing and catching, and we stuck a ball in his hand. I had some other people there. We videotaped it. It was real special stuff, and he's throwing the ball real clear, no problem. He goes back to Georgia. This is up in New York. Goes back to Alabama, and all of a sudden he could throw batting practice. You know, because whatever he was carrying in his nervous system, in his brain, in his body, was identified, lit up, brain spotted out, and he was clear. You know, and he's a big advocate for this. Now you talk about Mike Pelfrey. Now, he's right at the tipping point. He literally, I read the article in the paper, and he said...
He said the word yips.
He said the yips, I had the yips and the mental block, okay, in relation to balking. Now, I guess it's not a problem for him when nobody's on base, but even when nobody's on base, he knows somebody's going to get on base, and it's going to come up. When it happens once, it's like an errant thing. It happens twice, it's like, what the hell's going on? By the time the third time happens, you're starting to get locked in. You start to anticipate it, and you have a symptom, and it's a symptom that doesn't go away on its own.
Mm-hmm.
It may briefly go away, and then it comes back and so on, but or it may go away and come out in another way. Like all of a sudden, he might not be able to, you know, throw the fastball. You know, every fastball goes high or something goes off. Mike Pelfrey is in jeopardy right now, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He's a great pitcher. He's got a great arm. He's got a good head, everything like this, but his career is beginning to tip, and it could tip the wrong way. He could be the next Rick Ankiel.
Yeah, on a softer level, Ali Perez, same thing.
Oh, absolutely.
But
by the way, before the Mets got him in the deal when they sent Nady over there, because
right.
He was, you know, he was having he had a great lefty arm, but he had all these control problems.
Yeah.
So, wow, big surprise coming
place,
up again.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
And again, this gets into, you know, Cynthia dealing with more the emotional aspect of someone's well-being, about how they feel about that event happening, which could then uncover a whole, you know, litany of things in their past of every time they felt the anxiety, this is what would happen to them, they lose the coordination, whatever. But I look at a guy like Murphy, who came up last year as a phenom, and, you know, the fans loved him, and all of a sudden he dropped that ball in Florida, and he's a bad fielder, and then he's got a bad arm, and then he can't catch line drives hit right at him, and now basically they're trying to find a place to hide this guy. They're going to stick him at first base tonight, like I was saying before, who's on first. And I guarantee the first time that Wright throws him a 38 hopper across the third base, that thing is going to skip down the right field line. He's going to be going, American League, American League. And it's like they seem to just basically find – and then this is being a Mets fan, I'm whining now. They seem to basically find a weak spot in any player that they have, and like last year with Church with the collisions, they will do everything in their power to tell the public what they think the public wants to hear, and then everything behind the scenes to make everything almost get more exacerbated. I mean, you know, how does Reyes have a calf problem on a plane and have to take 5 days off? It just seems like the whole organization needs to be brain spotted.
you think?
I really say that they think that they could deny it away. This is what you were saying. The culture in sports is to deny trauma, to deny that you feel pain, to deny that you need help. And then when you try to treat all these different symptoms, it's, you know, Cynthia can attest to this, when someone comes in and it's like they start springing a leak and you say they'll compensate, it'll show up somewhere else, you end up chasing all these symptoms rather than rooting the person in their awareness of the way that things are arising so that they can actually, you know, override that and as you say, transcend it like Mackie did. And then at a certain point they become empowered. They start to trust their body again. And trust is a big issue when it comes to this kind of stuff, because you can't stick a fork in why you can't throw the ball back to the pitcher. The muscles work, the eyes work, the brain works. Why can't you do it? I don't know. Third base, you know, becomes one of these mysteries. And I just feel like your stuff, once someone experiences it, much like with EMDR and some of the other disciplines that involve, you know, ocular lock and things like that, I stumbled over something called hemispheric integration last night. Somebody emailed me about that. Maybe we'll get that guy on the show. He deals with the other mind's eye, which is another whole deal. Is that once people are dealing with that aspect of their inner world, they at a certain point they become sensitive and they become more competent in almost anticipating that they're going back into the skid, and they could actually course correct their way out of it by regulating their physiology more. So how many sessions or how much of an exposure they need to brain spotting until the process becomes a little more self-directed by the client, and now you can start doing positive physiology work rather than trying to negate the stress physiology they walked in the door with? I'll let David answer first, and then maybe Cynthia can give us a couple of examples.
Okay. First of all, Daniel Murphy, you know what his problem is?
He's
not a left fielder.
Well, he was in the major leagues. Yeah, he was
a second baseman. And they decided to make him into a left fielder. Well, you know what?
Yeah.
You know, you go into the media market in New York, you stick a second baseman out in left field, and he's not a left fielder. You know, you're putting him in a vulnerable position, okay? And
well,
he makes
that
a couple mistakes.
They got the first baseman was an outfielder. He put him on first base. He threw the ball to the dugout the other night.
Right. So, yeah. So, if you play somebody out of position, don't be surprised when they start making errors, okay? And then don't be surprised that they get traumatized and that they feel vulnerable because they don't have the muscle memory that they have at second base where they're used to the ball coming at them.
It's supposed to be natural, but, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, what the hell was
so a guy like Knobloch, who played second base his whole life, and then one day starts whipping the ball in the stands, you know,
what
happened to him?
You know what happened to him? His father was dying of Alzheimer's disease. His wife divorced him. Okay.
Wow.
And he probably had some other injury issues there. And wow, it's a big surprise. Let me show you the greatest one of this, okay?
Okay.
Steve Blass disease. You ever hear that?
Steve Blass disease?
B-L-A-S-S. Pitcher. He was a pitcher for the Pirates in the 60s. Steve Blass.
Okay.
Control pitcher, 20-game winner, pitch in the World Series, all this stuff. And then one season he comes back, and he can't get the ball over the plate. And for the next few years, it got worse and worse, and then he's out of baseball. You know what nobody ever asked? Like, what the hell happened? During the off season, before he developed the Steve Blass disease, the pitching yips, Roberto Clemente, his best friend, was killed in a plane crash. Okay? Wow.
Pretty obvious, yeah. Nobody asked them.
And you know what? You will not find that the connection made with that any place. But you'll just Google Steve Blass disease, and you'll see that was the origin of pitching yips, even though you know it was out a long time before that. So, but basically, again, you through your chiropractic work and us through our psychoneurophysiological work, we're entering into the same system from different places. But it's still the neurophysiology, okay? And if a problem, if there's a problem in the neurophysiology, first you have to find out where it is, and then you have to find out how to remediate it. Sometimes a chiropractor is better able to do it, and sometimes a brain spotting therapist or a neuro-based therapist is better able to do it. And sometimes you need both working together. You know?
Well, again, this is what I got more basically compadres from behavioral optometrists and people that did behavior work, because I'm not a crunch crack chiropractor per se, because I feel like that can be, as Cynthia was saying before, when you're imposing on the system rather than letting the system compose itself and become more aware, become more independent. And so, you know, from the strict chiropractic clinical angle, you know, where they're dealing with a third person perspective of the physical body and not looking at the first person experience that's happening within it, this is why we'll get into this window thing here for a minute. When you guys speak of an inner window, that's the client experiencing themselves. Do they report back, you know, sensations? Do they give you kind of almost like a way to kind of perceive what's happening as they're happening? Or you just say, I want you to go within and I want you to just experience it and come back when you're ready? How would you prompt someone to go into that inner window and get information for you?
Well, the inner window is, as David was talking before, how we use a pointer. So when they go inside and I'm tracking their eyes, David described before how you ask the client, well, we want to find out where there is a point where they're looking, where there's the most amount of distress.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're asking them to give us feedback to help them find that point.
Okay, so the inner window is sort of a coordination between their physical state and where they're moving their eyes along these pointers to sort of resonate A to B. And then once you got that, that's your window.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah,
and then the outer
window. That's your frame.
Yeah, okay, that's the frame you're going
to
work in for that session.
Right.
And again, would you do multiple brain spots per session or just work on one per time to let them kind of like, you know, integrate these things, in a series, or you can layer them?
Well, something that you had pointed out before, you said, like, when do they get to more of the relaxed physiology?
Right.
Well, sometimes what you do is you set up a resource.
Okay.
So you find a resource point, and you may have them put that, like, know where that spot is and put that on the wall, and then do the more distressing point so that they always have a frame of reference to go back to if it's too dysregulating.
And they're using
They're processing.
Okay.
But as they're processing, you're going to it's going to calm down.
Mm-hmm. Now, will they take that out the door saying, okay, I know that like at 2 o'clock I'm cool here, but at 3:30 I'm going to be in the tank. Do they have a map of this going out the door to know that these different areas are going to elicit different physiological recall, or is it something that you can actually sketch it out and tomorrow all those spots don't matter and you're back to square one? Either one of you.
Do you want to answer that, David?
No, you take that, Cynthia. You're on a roll.
So, it may come back, it may not come back. No, we don't give them a map that's going out the door. However, there is a more complex resourcing thing that's called the constellation that they find that and they get a felt sense. A lot of what we also work with is a felt sense, so they have something more internal. It's not necessarily eye position at 3 o'clock. But they may intuitively recall their session. Like I personally have had sessions where like I'll like move my eyes in a certain direction and while I'm walking around like the next day or the day after, and I'll see that frame and it will recall, but I won't consciously have been doing that per se.
Right. Well, once you've had that surface experience, it these things are all neurologically linked. You'll get that cascade will go through your system again, and instead of going into a stress physiology, go into what I used to call a bliss physiology, where the body feels safe, there's good neuroception. Hey, I got a good channel. It's like the ham radio went, oh, look, I got a station here. And you're not going to consciously go, okay, look up and a little to the left, and there it is. But you know the system intuitively knows where to go, and it could take a half a beat just to glance up there, and it gets it back. I've seen that happen all the time.
Yeah, but the thing is, because the system is continuously processing, and it's a mindful thing,
mm-hmm.
it's continuously changing, so that spot that was once a disturbing place to look no longer necessarily is that anymore.
Right.
So my system's not going to keep going back necessarily to the same spot.
No, again, I'm looking at it from the standpoint of there's a structure and then there's a function. The structure of the eye positions that you're talking about is more of a way to sort of, I hate the way to say
it. It's a tool.
Yeah, it's metaphorically, it's sort of like giving you an outer target that, again, there is a sort of an etch-a-sketch because 70% of the energy you spend there in a day is moving your eyes around, so they're constantly moving. But the thing is, like, when you're dealing with people that have vestibular issues or they've come from a car accident or they come from some direct trauma that they're conscious of, eye movement and the body response are, it's almost like, you know, when there's a train wreck. I mean, you have to get those established biological tracks established again, you know, kind of like back functioning again, while they're doing this search. And maybe because you guys are dealing with things that are a little bit more on the physiological side, not necessarily on the structural side, you're getting the functional aspects or the dysfunctional aspects addressed because they're dealing with a lot more memory. They're dealing with a lot more, disorganization, if you will, physiological entropy, I guess you call it, where there's a lot of noise, and you're giving them a new signal, and then now they have a good signal-to-noise ratio, and their physiology can upgrade. You know, you guys are dealing with a lot more kind of a wider bandwidth of issues there.
From a structural point of view, what we find is that with many people, when the psychoneurophysiological trauma or event or whatever it is processed through, that the system just sort of self-corrects in a lot of different ways, and that a lot of things don't have to be directed because they just kind of happen on their own.
Yeah, well, again, how would you guys, maybe this is something that this approach doesn't really address directly, but dealing with things that are more developmental, when you're dealing with the dyslexia, when you're dealing with ADD, you know, where the kid's coming in and they've got, you know, again, they've got a litany of things that they've tried. Dave, do you want to handle that one? How would you approach that type of a case?
I'll give you the ABC of that with ADD, and this can apply.
The ABC of ADD, okay.
People who have ADD know the ADD feeling, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to put it into words, but it kind of feels like distractibility, anxiety, stress, whatever it is. But I use a particular type of technique called one-eye brain spotting. So what we do is we have the person activate the ADD feeling, okay, and we rate it 0 to 10. You know, 0 is none, 10 is the most. Usually it'll jack up to 8, 9, 10, whatever it is. Then we have a person cover one eye and try to activate it, and they see what the number is, and then they cover the other eye, and they activate it. Usually on one eye, it's more active than the other, okay?
Right.
We're going right after the middle of it, so right after the most intense aspect of it. So we have the person put on goggles where only the eye that's exposed is the more active eye, okay? And then we find the brain spot on that eye, again, where the person feels the ADD feeling the most acutely. And then from there, and wherever they feel it in the body, they start to observe their internal process, and it goes on and on and on. And as time goes on, memories will come up or body sensations, whatever it is, the number tends to drop. And we go with it until it's at a baseline of 0, which, you know, oftentimes doesn't happen in one session. But let's say it does. Person gets to a 0, we're not done. Okay, the next thing we say is, I want you to try to activate that ADD feeling again. Now remember, they're on the same brain spot, and they activate it. Let's say it flares up to a 5 now. Where do you feel it in your body? Oh, it's in my chest. Process it through, comes back to a 0. You do that again and again and again until they cannot activate the ADD feeling. Next step, we then go over to the other eye where it was less before, switch goggles, opposite side, find a new brain spot. It's generally not going to be as high, but there's still going to be a lot of that experience left. It's all felt sense. Have the person process down, again, to a 0 suds, activate it again, go through it again until the person on that eye can't feel the ADD feeling. Take the goggles off, same thing. If there's anything left, we find the spot. Now, that doesn't mean the person, you know, doesn't have ADD, but they go out, they go back into the environment, which stimulates all this stuff, and then we see them in the next session, a week or two later, whatever it is. We then see what activated the ADD feeling. We have them imaginally go to it, activate it. We go through the same process again. You do this session after session after session, a person cannot activate the ADD feeling, okay? I mean, this is a way of dealing with it by what it feels like, okay,
right.
By felt sense. So if a person can't activate the ADD feeling, then you have the philosophical question, do they still have ADD? Which I'm not quite sure what the answer is, but the question is important.
Well, I've always, you know, maybe this is something Cynthia and I, you know, deal with more directly, where people come in with a label from wherever they came from the allopathic side, because of the way they're acting in a certain environment. And ADD in a classroom, ADD in a clinician's office might be two different things. Same thing with autism, which that's why they invented the spectrum. And the individual can choose to internalize that. And I always make this apparent, to, especially this time of the year with when the asthma meds come out, there's asthma and there's asthmatic. Okay, so I'll always say, or there's charcoal-laden crystals in their sputum. I say it like, you know, like I'm talking like one of them. And they go, what? I go, well, to have asthma, you need the pathognomonic of charcoal-laden crystals in your sputum. And the kid's wheezing. That's all we have. We have a symptom of asthma. It's asthmatic, mm-hmm. but it's not asthma. ADD has an ADD-ish kind of a pattern. There's real ADD where there's, you know, basically there's transnodal degeneration, there's frontal lobe development problems, there's a lot of severe stuff. And then there's these other things that are clinically accepted as ADD or LD or any other Ds. Oppositional defiant disorder is my favorite one now. When the amygdala goes south and they go, oh, that's, you're just a really bratty kid. We're going to put a label on you. And the identity thing, this is gets into some of the deeper work you guys do where we're dealing with the third eye maybe, where the person is actually seeing this lifetime from a perspective of vulnerability, from a perspective of weakness, from a perspective of, you know, I'm not enough. And a lot of the symptomatology that comes up is you know, in somatics they call it bodies in revolt, where the body says, no, I'm intelligent, I'm going to show you. And you have this sort of internal conflict that's happening behind the wall where they're not really perceiving it. This type of process where you're engaging the eyes in basically mundane movement patterns. You're not asking them to do any fancy tricks. You're just basically scanning the system, using the eyes as extensions of the brain, which they are, to see what's going on both in the limbic system, where the behaviors are being, you know, sort of organized and motor-coded up, and also cognitively where they're becoming aware. So how do you deal with the stuff that's below that, where it's more, you know, other than conscious or even completely unconscious, where you're dealing with physiology that's, maybe it's nightmares, maybe it's happening when they're not awake, and that's where they need the brain spotting. Either one of you.
Cynthia, you take it.
Okay.
Well, I'm thinking of, like, couple of people that I've recently worked with like a restless leg.
Okay. That's okay. A perfect example. Yeah.
So that's an example where it's kind of a physiological thing. They've been on all kinds of meds. They're going to different doctors. They can't sleep. They don't know what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like what David talked about with the sports stuff. It's like, well, when did it start? And so I'm going back to the point of origin. And in both these situations, it happens to have been you know, certain incidences, but there was a certain level of anxiety and difficulty sleeping for like many years. And so then you work with it from the trauma of what was going on and then what's before that. And then, you know, in both these situations, it had to do with free-floating anxiety and, you know, nobody really holding and no attachment. And so then giving them the resource of finding that within themselves, and now they're able to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like really go, you know, to track things back to where it's something started or where there was health before that incident is a great way to kind of clear through a lot of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and again, I guess my follow-up to that as sort of a way to kind of go around about the whole issue there of identity and recall, is that when someone comes in with a label like that, you know, restless leg syndrome, whatever they want to call it, bouffitis is usually what I tell them it is that they have to get leverage about that label, where that label doesn't overpower them. And again, if the whole idea is just to get them back to neutral, to make it go away, they kind of live in fear of it coming back. So it's like, my headache went away. I go, where'd it go? So the issue of time is the thing I want to get at here, because maybe this is something that will help me out in understanding how you guys do the preliminary work, is that people have timelines that are either kinesthetic and through the body, or they're visual and they're in front of the body. And so in my work, there's an intended self timeline that goes, you know, like people will say, I'm looking forward to the weekend, and the past is behind them, you know. So they're on the shish kebab. So they can't really see their past, but they can feel it. Or if they're more in an extended self pattern, they could see that time's like a train going in front of their eyes. But most people seem to travel from past to present to future. That's why they can't make any changes, where intention is always about coming from the future to the present. How do you get them to be aware of their issues with the way that they're dealing with time frames as they tell their story? Because I'll watch people when they're telling me, like, when did it start? You ask them a question like that, and they're not they're looking down. They're not looking on the visual timeline. They're going kinesthetic. So everything basically becomes more of a body event where the body's not sorting for that. So how do you get them to sort or to hang events in time outside their body so then they can then basically see the events and not re-experience them as they're telling them? Or that maybe that's not your goal.
Well, first of all, we do a session and then we do a follow-up session. So
okay.
In the follow-up session, we get the timeline of whatever happened in between the treatment and the follow-up session. So that gives us some basis for seeing, you know, us and the client for some basis of seeing what actually happened, for, you know, in between. And then you do another session, and then, you know, the time in between the session is actually more important than the session itself.
Mm-hmm.
So we're actually working with a timeline that way. But the other thing is because brain spotting is so neurophysiological and down to the reflexive core. My concept is that the ultimate cueing of where something is psychologically is the spine, you know, which would probably be interesting for you here as a chiropractor.
Is the
that,
spine? Well,
yeah.
Not the spinal cord, the spine itself.
Yeah. Well, the spinal cord. You know,
spinal cord.
In other words, it's not just the limbic system. It's not just the brain stem. It goes all the way into the spine. Okay?
Yeah.
And at that level, there is no sense of consciousness, no sense of connection. It is just
right.
All survival mechanisms. Okay.
Yeah, you have a pattern intelligence down there.
Yeah, it's all. I mean, by the way, the language that you speak, like,
yeah.
has such application to the work that Cynthia and I do. But
mm-hmm.
there are very few people in our field who actually think that way or understand that. You know, and this is where the crossover in between your field and our field is so crucial, because we have so much that we have to share with each other, so we really
yeah.
know what the hell's going on.
Take me on the road. I travel.
Okay.
I don't talk to anyone in my discipline anymore because they make me nuts. So I'll talk to anybody else.
Yeah,
that's why
yeah,
I do the
well,
show mostly.
If we put you in a U-Haul, will you come with us? I mean, does it work that way?
As long as we get the Met game on Sirius or something, I'm cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, but what I'm saying is we don't care. Like,
mm-hmm.
we don't go for the material. We don't go for the content. We go for the experience and the process.
Right.
And because we know that the spine and the brainstem are the substrate to that which is called psychology or emotions or personality. So we bypass all that stuff. You know, we're not that concerned with it. We don't say that to the client, but basically, you know, when we're saying where do you feel it the most, or when we're going where do we see the most reflexes, I mean, that's pretty primitive stuff. You know, that's watching the reptile. You know,
right.
And if you heal the reptile, then everything else kind of falls into place. All this stuff about timeline and body, it really becomes irrelevant. You know.
Well, that's my NLP argument against NLP sometimes, is that because they came from the cognitive side in the 70s, you know, this is their whole deal, is that for all of their somatic submodalities and anchoring and stuff, they don't care about the body. They care about their
that's
mind.
Right.
They care, you know. And so what happens is that they divide the person again. Forget space and time. It's mind body. It's it becomes again a compartmentalization. So you might get an anchor to override something, or sometimes the work like Dialectics works with, where they do a trace. I don't know if
mm-hmm.
you're familiar with Doyle Henderson's work. It's another one of these inner vision processes. Like, but you guys are again, if you just engage them on both sides of it at the same time, they can't divide it anymore. Moving the
mm-hmm.
eyes and reporting, you're now getting what happens in everyday life. Because everyday life, there is no division. It's only when you go to the doctor and you get a diagnosis, then, okay, shrinks this way and the intern is that way. It's like, you know, but like you said before with that guy, the pitcher, if they just would have asked this guy, well, what happened to you in the last, oh, my friend died in a plane crash. That's why I can't throw the baseball anymore, because every time I'm on the mound, I think of my friend. Oh!
Right.
You're not in a bubble.
Yeah, well, the problem with Blass is that he didn't make the conscious connection. And anybody else that he went to for help didn't make the conscious connection. You know, unconsciously he was fried, but consciously
yeah.
he was dissociated, so he didn't even know what was coming from where. Okay,
yeah.
but
he had a sleeping reptile, and that was not
yeah.
downloaded, and the rest of him was floundering around up there in his skull.
Yeah, And by the way, you look at any athlete who develops the yips, and you'll see in their present life and their history, it's all there. It's so obvious. But, you know, but again, from the cognitive point of view, the cognitive therapist, the CBT therapist, say what you think affects how you feel and how you feel in the body. Well, you know what? I think they got it upside down. You know, it's like, yes, what you think can affect what you feel in the body, but it starts in the body first, okay?
Well, this gets into, and we'll take a little sideline here into the Wooville, because you guys travel in those circles like me, is that the whole movement in the last 4 or 5 years of the create your own reality, which I bash on almost like on every other show basis here with the secret people and the bleep people and all this other stuff, where you can literally, you know, imagine yourself rich and sit in front of a blank board and the world's going to come to your doorstep and just throw money at you. Again, this is a sort of a bubblegum version of positive physiology where you're trying to, like what Cynthia said at the top of the interview here, you're imposing on a system that has achieved a certain level of equilibrium. This, it's almost like trying to take a drink from a fire hydrant. And then saying, "Oh, you're still thirsty? Here's a fire hose," you know. And it's like, and people get the weekend, sort of like car wash, and they get all that out of their head because they're exposed to this very intense environment, like Tony Robbins did back in the 80s and 90s with all those sales guys that were running around, you know, trying to be Gordon Gekko. You get them all upregulated into this frenzied state, and there's always going to be a valley after that peak, and then of course. It's the Tuesday after the workshop, and they're sitting there probably in one of our offices going, "What happened?" And I'm saying, "You went on a roller coaster. That's what happened." And how do you?
But Mark,
people,
also, like, from what you said before, like somebody comes with the label or now they're looking for their headache. So if somebody goes and does something like that, if they really haven't shifted and changed, then do they really even want the creation that they say that they want?
Well, yeah, that gets into that woo circle where they're not. I said you don't create your own reality. Reality is the default setting. You have to be able to merge with reality and interact with it, and not try to change it, but try to basically interchange or exchange with it, so you get the resources you need and you get the parsley off your plate. There's a lot of people walking around with a lot of basically parenchyma, a lot of baggage, a lot of basically empty vessels. And the thing about thought, again, to me, that's the last thing. Usually it's a reflective, it's about reflective core. It's the last thing that the person becomes aware of, because most of the time we're not aware of our thoughts, and they're repetitive anyway. It's the impulse to act, it's the impulse to have a feeling, and then to let that thing kind of rhythmically move through our systems. But because our culture is pretty much atonal, arrhythmic, we unless it's, you know, watching MTV or something, it doesn't really teach us to center ourselves physically. In our environment, we try to center ourselves mentally, which is like, you know, like going outside and trying to catch a firefly, because the mind is constantly, like you said before, it's processing all the time, and it doesn't have near the responsibility that the body does. The body's in a gravitational environment, and if you walk off a cliff, you're going to fall, no matter how much you read The Secret on the way down. So it's like, you know, it's one of these things. I think maybe you guys, by being on the cutting edge of this and sort of talking to both camps, east, west, north, south, and getting them to understand that the physiology is universal. No matter what belief system, you know, I say, you know, the show is beyond the BS, beyond the belief system, no matter what belief system you impose on that or superimpose on that, that's the common ground. Why can't we start from there and work our way up? Because then when we get into this, you know, these weird fruits we pull out of the tree at the top of the stalk here, we know which ones are kind of, kind of poison, mangoes for us, and we don't need to go there anymore because they're not going to give us anything but what we got the last time, which is another trip down the mountain with another label, which I think at the last count there was about 70, 75 labels they're giving these kids with all these behavioral problems. And as you guys have demonstrated to me, most of it is just a lack of integrated physiology and these myriad of brain spots that they're not able to process because they're not even aware of them, and the clinicians aren't aware of them either. So what's the next step? Are we going to get a bullhorn and go out on the corner? And, you know, how do we get people to get excited about this where they think of it? Because it on its surface, it seems extremely simple, Mm-hmm. To get all these complex things and grab all these strings and have these big balloons of all these different, like we've covered about everything here, restless legs and yips. And how do we get people to understand that here's a very basic procedure that has wide application to a myriad of issues that people suffer with endlessly and try to, drug down into the ground? How do we get them to appreciate, understand something that on the surface looks pretty basic?
Well, we go on Mark Filippi's show.
There you go. Well, sure. Everybody listening to this show is tuning into the Met game now to see what's going on with Murphy, probably. But
go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just saying. Getting the word out through the paradigm that we're dealing with, where people are looking for a quick fix. This can absolutely be perceived as a quick fix. Even though it's not a quick fix. You're freeing the system up.
Right.
How do you get people to accept that responsibility? Otherwise, to me, it becomes another one of these bottle rockets where they're coming out of these seminars and they're all jazzed up and they're sitting in traffic, the horn blows, and boop, recall, and they're back where they started. How do you get them to be empowered enough to maintain that momentum after the initial, getting the thorn out of their foot?
Well, real fast on Tony Robbins, okay?
Yeah.
The Nets back in the 80s brought in Tony Robbins because they had such a bad season, and he worked with them in the preseason, and they went out and they lost their first 12 games. Okay. Tony Robbins was brought in by Greg Norman the Shark because 2 years in a row he choked in the last round of the Masters, and was up by like 8 and lost by like 5 strokes, okay?
Yeah, he classic choke, yeah.
And Tony Robbins solved the problem of Norman choking on the last day of the finals because he worked with Norman, and Norman didn't make the cut, okay?
Wow, there's a problem. He solved it. He just made sure it wasn't there on Sunday.
Well, he solved the same problem that he solved with the Nets, Like,
right.
But you know what? If your marketing is good enough, and you blow your horn enough, but to be a little bit more positive, I first of all, Cynthia goes out and has been giving presentations on brain spotting, and I've given trainings in South America, United States, Europe, Israel,
mm-hmm.
Turkey. So we've trained 2,200 therapists now, and
wow.
And I'm like the Willie Loman of brain spotting. I'm just out there on the road doing training after training, and you know what? Because not only does it work, but I teach it in a common sense way, and none of the baloney, and none of the you got to do it my way or it's the highway, or you got to do it my way or it's not going to work. What I teach right from the beginning is, brain spotting is made to be integrated and innovative. Okay, and if you go back and try to do it my way, you will not be as successful as if you try to go back to your office and use brain spotting your way, figure out your way of doing it. It's a very open model, and it's a very encouraging model, and it's a very reality-based model. That's kind of appealing, and therapists feel freed up by that. They feel safer with that. And when
you're including them.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. You're making it social, saying, look, your influence, your background, your skills matter here because you're the missing ingredient in that client interaction. Mm-hmm. I'm giving you another tool to funnel all that intelligence into the session. So it's very empowering for someone to hear that.
Yeah. And instead of most of the trainings, when they talk to seasoned therapists like they don't know anything they have to learn it this way and basically trash everything they've done before. Well, experiential
mm-hmm.
wisdom, for a healing person is what we really go on. So because I give it positive, because everything about brain spotting has to be integrated together. You can't have a great healing technique and then teach it in a traumatizing way, or a turf-oriented
mm-hmm.
way, I'm thrilled because I get everybody from CBT people to Jungian analysts to people who do core energetics, like Cynthia and basically what I say to them is, it's great that you have the skill you have. Now I'm going to teach you brain spotting, and you're going to figure out how to use brain spotting with what you're doing already. So because we wash out a lot of the negative stuff, the baloney, it's kind of spreading, it's only been 3 years, only 6 years since I first had that experience where I saw an ice skater just like totally transform. and I went from doing EMDR to brain spotting without even knowing it. It's only been 6 years, and so you know we're pretty optimistic about where we're at, and you know we're looking ahead for the rest of 2009 into 2010. More and more trainings are going on, and it's really spreading all over Europe and South America. So, it's positive.
Well, I applaud you guys' efforts. I know Cynthia has a training coming up locally here in New York. I guess it's a couple weeks from now. When is it? June
13th.
June 13th, okay, over in White Plains.
Saturday.
Okay.
In White
Plains,
yeah.
The contact for that, just so people listening can get a hold of you as well.
They can email me at cscyntha@aol.com, and they can also call me at 917-816-3534.
Okay, and if anyone missed that or they just weren't with a pen when she said it, just get a hold of me at nakedsoma@gmail.com. I'll pass it along to you because I just think, again, the more people get an experience like this where they can actually see behind the curtain, so to speak, about the way their system really operates and they get to know themselves at a deeper level, I'm all for it. And like I said, I think you guys have one of the most tolerant outlooks I've ever had on the show because, again, the mindset mostly when you're marketing something is to say everything else is horrible and this is the new and improved, this is the new thing, and you throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I think you alienate a lot of the people that would be more receptive to your work, and it does become a turf war. I don't know how it ends on the – you guys get a lot of woos and a lot of moos coming into your tent. That are bringing in worldviews that don't often, you know, sit together unless it's jury duty. So the fact that you've been able to cultivate this is remarkable. And anything I can do to help you out, to get that across, because I travel with a lot of these behavioral optometrists that they have the Bates method, and this is all they do. And to show them, you know, something with color or something with balance is like, oh my God, what am I doing? It's like they feel almost like a disloyalty, like they've left the church of the good or something.
Well, they can bring this back to the church. So
yes, I have the 11th commandment from David here.
There's also the Norman Bates version where they look up at that house on the hill, you know.
The Norman Bates. Well, believe me, when you go, if you've gone into any of these behavioral optometrists' office where they got, you know, the wiffle ball is sliding on a string in people's heads. I mean, they don't look as conventional as they think they do. But you know, so just to wrap up, both of you, we've covered a lot of ground here. What is the number one misconception about brain spotting that if someone just Googled it or came upon it, you know, on a flyer, that you'd like to just hose off the windshield right now for him and let David go first?
Okay. That you have to be trained in EMDR to come to a brain spotting training.
That's a big hook.
That's a misconception, yeah.
Good. Okay. Cynthia, you got one?
I can't think of one off the top of my head.
Oh, she's got a spot.
Do you have another one?
Move your eyes up and you'll see if I...
major misconception.
Yeah, people don't understand about brain spotting. They think it's something it's not.
Oh, I think that it's a misconception to think that it's an eye positioning technique.
Okay. Yeah, because people think, basically, it's like, I don't have an eye problem. Why do I have to go for brain spotting? I mean, it's very similar with somatics or with any of these body-based psychotherapies where they think, well, I don't have any pain. Like, you don't need pain to get in the door. It's like I always say people show up because of three reasons. It's either trauma, drama, or karma. Each one of those will get you together with me. And then from there we put that away and we work on some fun stuff. But I just think the culture at large is suffering so much, especially, I mean, it's, what is it, 2009. I'm still dealing with people here that are trying to resolve issues from 9/11.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they're still wandering around. Yeah, I mean, they quit jobs, they moved, and they tried to hide, they drug themselves into oblivion, and they're still walking around with those issues. And a tool like what you're talking about here can help them resolve a lot of stuff that they've been holding on to. I mean, Mackie held on to his stuff for 17 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
People are, like I said, I think there's a lot of human suffering out there that this can alleviate. And I thank you guys from the bottom of my heart to come on the show and spend so much time here and explain it, because hopefully people can archive, listen back, and get a taste of what it's like. You guys are wonderful to work with, and I thank you for joining us on the show tonight.
Great. Thanks a lot, Mark. This was great.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah.
Take care, guys.
Okay.
Have a life.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. So there you go, guys. There's brain spotting. That was a clinic those guys did. I like having two people on the show, a little bouncy bounce. And, if you have any questions about it, let me know, because it's something that I'm interested in
for a variety of reasons. I just think when you find people that you resonate with, that you really want to work with, I don't think there should be so many obstacles in the way, and no matter what their background is or whatever. So, you know, we'll leave that as it be. And next week we have a colossal guest coming on the show. Oh, I have to bow now because I'm so excited. The lovely and talented and imperial Douglas Rushkoff is coming on the show to talk about his new book, Life Incorporated. You guys are getting a treat next week as we have the early, Memorial Day weekend here coming up. And then right after that, we'll be into the Rushkoff, because I'm telling you, if you want memes, if you want to know about what's happened to us, if you want all that stuff, this is your man. But first, a little segue here as we head out the door tonight to watch the Mets blow another two-out rally. I think Murphy's up there now. So everyone, have a great long weekend. We'll see you here next Wednesday night at 9 for Rushkoff. Here it comes, baby. The summer. Ugh. I'll let Frankie take us out. You guys sashay, keep your eyes moving. And I will talk to you next week at 9 o'clock. Until then, thank you for this time and your space. Be yourself and be well.
All summer long, we sang a song. And then we strolled that golden sand. Two sweethearts and the summer wind. Like painted kites, those days and nights, they went flying by. The world was new beneath a blue umbrella sky.
The 2-2 to Murphy.
Then a piper man, one day it called to you.
That's a strike three looking.
I lost you to the summer wind. The autumn winds and the winter winds, they have come and gone. And still the days, those lonely days, they go on and on. And guess who sighs?
At least the Phillies lost. Travel light, guys.